apartment with the assistance of a ladder in night apparel. Having gained admittance in the same fashion, a factor the weeklies, addicted to the lubric a little, simply coined shoals of money out of. Whereas the simple fact of the case was, it was simply a case of the husband not being up to the scratch, with nothing in common between them beyond the name, and then a real man arriving on the scene, strong to the verge of weakness, falling a victim to her siren charms and forgetting home ties. The usual sequel to bask in the loved one's smiles. The eternal question of the life connubial, needless to say, cropped up. Can real love, supposing there happens to be another chap in the case, exist between married folk? Though it was no concern of theirs, absolutely, if you regarded her with affection carried away by a wave of folly. A magnificent specimen of manhood he was, truly, augmented, obviously, by gifts of a high order, as compared with the other military supernumerary, that is, who was just the usual everyday farewell my gallant captain kind of an individual in the light dragoons, the 18th Hussars, to be accurate, and inflammable, doubtless, the fallen leader, that is, not the other, in his own peculiar way, which she, of course, woman, quickly perceived as highly likely to carve his way to fame, which he almost bid fair to do, till the priests and ministers of the gospel as a whole, his erstwhile staunch adherents and his beloved evicted tenants, for whom he had done yeoman service in the rural parts of the country by taking up cudgels on their behalf in a way that exceeded their most sanguine expectations, very effectually cooked his matrimonial goose, thereby heaping coals of fire on his head, much in the same way as the fable ass's kick. Looking back now, in a retrospective kind of arrangement, all seemed a kind of dream. And the coming back was the worst thing you ever did, because it went without saying you would feel out of place, as things always moved with the times. Why, as he reflected, Irishtown Strand, a locality he had not been in for quite a number of years, looked different somehow since, as it happened, he went to reside on the north side. North or south, however, it was just a well-known case of hot passion, pure and simple, upsetting the apple cart with a vengeance, and just bore out the very thing he was saying, as she also was Spanish, or half so, types that wouldn't do things by halves, passionate abandon of the south, casting every shred of decency to the winds. "Just bears out what I was saying," he with glowing bosom said to Stephen, "and if I don't greatly mistake, she was Spanish too." "The King of Spain's daughter," Stephen answered, adding something rather muddled about farewell and adieu to you Spanish onions, and the first land called the dead man, and from Ramhead to Scilly was so and so many. "Was she?" Bloom ejaculated, surprised, though not astonished by any means. "I never heard that rumour before. Possible, especially there it was, as she lived there. So, Spain." Carefully avoiding a book in his pocket, sweets of, which reminded him, by the by, of that Capel Street Library book out of date, he took out his pocket-book, and turning over the various contents rapidly, finally he, "Do you consider," by the by, he said, thoughtfully selecting a faded photo which he laid on the table, "that a Spanish type?" Stephen, obviously addressed, looked down on the photo, showing a large-sized lady with her fleshy charms on evidence in an open fashion, as she was in the full bloom of womanhood, in evening dress, cut ostentatiously low for the occasion, to give a liberal display of bosom, with more than vision of breasts, her full lips parted, and some perfect teeth, standing near, ostensibly with gravity, a piano, on the rest of which was In Old Madrid, a ballad, pretty in its way, which was then all the vogue. Her, the lady's, eyes, dark, large, looked at Stephen, about to smile about something to be admired, Lafayette of Westmoreland Street, Dublin's premier photographic artist, being responsible for the aesthetic execution. "Mrs. Bloom, my wife, the prima donna, Madame Marion Tweedy," Bloom indicated, "taken a few years since, in or about 96. Very like her then." Beside the young man, he looked also at the photo of the lady, now his legal wife, who, he intimated, was the accomplished daughter of Major Brian Tweedy, and displayed at an early age remarkable proficiency as a singer, having even made her bow to the public when her years numbered barely sweet 16. As for the face, it was a speaking likeness in expression, but it did not do justice to her figure, which came in for a lot of notice usually, and which did not come out to the best advantage in that get-up. She could, without difficulty, he said, have posed for the ensemble, not to dwell on certain opulent curves of the... He dwelt, being a bit of an artist in his spare time, on the female form in general, developmentally, because, as it so happened, no later than that afternoon, he had seen those Grecian statues perfectly developed as works of art in the National Museum. Marble could give the original, shoulders back, all the symmetry. All the rest, yes, Puritanism. It does, though, said Joseph Sovereign, whereas no photo could because it simply wasn't art in a word. The spirit moving him, he would much have liked to follow Jack Tar's good example and leave the likeness there for a very few minutes to speak for itself on the plea he... so that the other could drink in the beauty for himself, her stage presence being frankly a treat in itself, which the camera could not at all do justice to. But it was scarcely professional etiquette, so, though it was a warm, pleasant sort of a night now, yet wonderfully cool for the season considering, for sunshine after storm, and he did feel a kind of need there and then to follow suit like a kind of inward voice and satisfy a possible need by moving a motion. Nevertheless, he sat tight, just viewing the slightly soiled photo, creased by opulent curves, none the worse for wear, however, and looked away thoughtfully, with the intention of not further increasing the other's possible embarrassment while gauging her symmetry of heaving embonpoint. In fact, the slight soiling was only an added charm, like the case of linen slightly soiled, good as new, much better, in fact, with the starch out. Suppose she was gone when he... I looked for the lamp which he told me, came into his mind, but merely as a passing fancy of his, because he then recollected the morning-littered bed, etc., and the book about Ruby with metempsychosis, sick, in it, which must have fell down sufficiently appropriately beside the domestic chamber pot, with apologies to Lindley Murray. The vicinity of the young man he certainly relished, educated, distingué, and impulsive into the bargain, far and away the pick of the bunch, though you wouldn't think he had it in him. Yet you would. Besides, he said the picture was handsome, which, say what you like, it was, though at the moment she was distinctly stouter. And why not? An awful lot of make-believe went on about that sort of thing, involving a lifelong slur with the usual splash page of letterpress about the same old matrimonial tangle alleging misconduct with professional golfer or the newer stage favourite, instead of being honest and above board about the whole business. How they were fated to meet, and an attachment sprang up between the two, so that their names were coupled in the public eye, was told in court, with letters containing the habitual mushy and compromising expressions, leaving no loophole, to show that they openly cohabited two or three times a week at some well-known seaside hotel, and relations, when the thing ran its normal course, became in due course intimate. Then the decree nisi, and the king's proctor to show cause why, and he failing to quash it, nisi was made absolute. But as for that, the two misdemeanants, wrapped up as they largely were in one another, could safely afford to ignore it, as they very largely did, till the matter was put in the hands of the solicitor, who filed a petition for the party wronged in due course. He, Bloom, enjoyed the distinction of being close to Aaron's uncrowned king in the flesh, when the thing occurred, on the historic fracas, when the fallen leaders, who notoriously stuck to his guns to the last drop, even when clothed in the mantle of adultery, leaders' trusty henchmen, to the number of 10 or 12 or possibly even more than that, penetrated into the printing works of the insuppressible, or no, it was United Ireland, and by no means, by the by, appropriate appellative, and broke up the typecases with hammers or something like that, all on account of some scurrilous effusions from the facile pens of the O'Brienite scribes at the usual mudslinging occupation, reflecting on the erstwhile tribune's private morals. Though palpably a radically altered man, he was still a commanding figure, though carelessly garbed as usual, with that look of settled purpose which went a long way with the shilly-shallyers, till they discovered to their vast discomfiture that their idol had feet of clay, after placing him upon a pedestal, which she, however, was the first to perceive. As those were particularly hot times in the general hullabaloo, Bloom sustained a minor injury from a nasty prod of some chap's elbow in the crowd that, of course, congregated, lodging some place about the pit of the stomach, fortunately not of a grave character. His hat, Parnell's, was inadvertently knocked off, and, as a matter of strict history, Bloom was the man who picked it up in the crush after witnessing the occurrence, meaning to return it to him, and return it to him he did with the utmost celerity, who, panting and hatless, and whose thoughts were miles away from his hat at the time, being a gentleman born with a stake in the country, he, as a matter of fact, having gone into it more for the kudos of the thing than anything else, what's bred in the bone, instilled into him in infancy at his mother's knee, in the shape of knowing what good form was, came out at once because he turned round to the donor and thanked him with perfect aplomb, saying, "Thank you, sir," though in a very different tone of voice from the ornament of the legal profession, whose headgear Bloom also set to rights earlier in the course of the day, history repeating itself with a difference, after the burial of a mutual friend, when they had left him alone in his glory after the grim task of having committed his remains to the grave. On the other hand, What incensed him more inwardly was the blatant jokes of the cabmen and so on, who passed it all off as a jest, laughing immoderately, pretending to understand everything, the why and the wherefore, and in reality not knowing their own minds, it being a case for the two parties themselves, unless it ensued that the legitimate husband happened to be a party to it, owing to some anonymous letter from the usual boy Jones, who happened to come across them at the crucial moment in a loving position, locked in one another's arms, drawing attention to their illicit proceedings and leading up to a domestic rumpus, and the erring fair one begging forgiveness of her lord and master upon her knees, and promising to sever the connection and not receive his visits any more, if only the aggrieved husband would overlook the matter and let bygones be bygones, with tears in her eyes, though possibly with her tongue in her fair cheek at the same time, as quite possibly there were several others. He personally, being of a sceptical bias, believed, and didn't make the smallest bones about saying so either, that man or men, in the plural, were always hanging around on the waiting list about a lady, even supposing she was the best wife in the world, and they got on fairly well together for the sake of argument, when, neglecting her duties, she chose to be tired of wedded life, and was on for a little flutter, in polite debauchery, to press their attentions on her with improper intent, the upshot being that her affection centred on another, the cause of many liaison between still attractive married women getting on for fair and forty and younger men, no doubt as several famous cases of feminine infatuation proved up to the hilt. It was a thousand pities a young fellow blessed with an allowance of brains, as his neighbour obviously was, should waste his valuable time with profligate women who might present him with a nice dose to last him his lifetime. In the nature of single blessedness, he would one day take unto himself a wife, when Miss Wright came on the scene. But in the interim, Lady Society was a conditio sine qua non, though he had the gravest possible doubts, not that he wanted in the smallest to pump Stephen about Miss Ferguson, who was very possibly the particular lodestar who brought him down to Irishtown so early in the morning, as to whether he would find much satisfaction basking in the boy and girl courtship idea, and the company of smirking misses without a penny to their names, bi or tri-weekly, with the orthodox preliminary canter of compliment-paying and walking out, leading up to fond lovers' ways and flowers and chocks. To think of him house and homeless, rooked by some landlady worse than any stepmother, was really too bad at his age. The queer suddenly things he popped out with attracted the elder man, who was several years the other senior, or like his father. But something substantial he certainly ought to eat, were it only an egg flip, made on unadulterated maternal nutriment, or, failing that, the homely Humpty Dumpty boiled. "At what o'clock did you dine?" he questioned of the slim form and tired, though unwrinkled, face.
"Sometime yesterday," Stephen said.
"Yesterday!" exclaimed Bloom, till he remembered it was already tomorrow, Friday. "Ah, you mean it's after 12. The day before yesterday," Stephen said, improving on himself. Literally astounded at this piece of intelligence, Bloom reflected. Though they didn't see eye to eye in everything, a certain analogy there somehow was, as if both their minds were travelling, so to speak, in the one train of thought. At his age, when dabbling in politics, roughly some score of years previously, when he had been a quasi-aspirant to parliamentary honours in the Buckshot Foster days, he too recollected in retrospect, which was a source of keen satisfaction in itself, he had a sneaking regard for those same ultra-ideas. For instance, when the evicted tenants question, then at his first inception, bulked largely in people's minds, though, it goes without saying, not contributing a copper or pinning his faith absolutely to its dictums, some of which wouldn't exactly hold water, he at the outset, in principle, at all events, was in thorough sympathy with peasant possession, as voicing the trend of modern opinion, a partiality, however, which, realizing his mistake, he was subsequently partially cured of, and even was twitted with going a step further than Michael Davitt in the striking views he at one time inculcated as a back-to-the-lander. Which was one reason he strongly resented the innuendo put upon him in so barefaced a fashion at the gathering of the clans in Barney Kiernan's, so that he, though often considerably misunderstood, and the least pugnacious of mortals, be it repeated, departed from his customary habit to give him, metaphorically, one in the gizzard. Though as far as politics themselves were concerned, he was only too conscious of the casualties invariably resulting from propaganda and displays of mutual animosity, and the misery and suffering it entailed as a foregone conclusion on fine young fellows, chiefly destruction of the fittest, in a word. Anyhow, upon weighing the pros and cons, getting on for one as it was high time to be retiring for the night. The crux was,
It was a bit risky to bring him home, as eventualities might possibly ensue, somebody having a temper of her own sometimes, and spoil the hash altogether, as on the night he misguidedly brought home a dog, breed unknown, with a lame paw. Not that the cases were either identical or the reverse, though he had hurt his hand, too, to Ontario Terrace, as he very distinctly remembered having been there, so to speak. On the other hand, it was altogether far and away too late for the Sandymount or Sandy Cove suggestion, so that he was in some perplexity as to which of the two alternatives. Everything pointed to the fact that it behoved him to avail himself to the full of the opportunity, all things considered. His initial impression was that he was a bit standoffish, or not over-effusive, but it grew on him some way. For one thing, he mightn't what you call jump at the idea, if approached, and what most worried him was he didn't know how to lead up to it, or word it exactly, supposing he did entertain the proposal, as it would afford him very great personal pleasure if he would allow him to help to put coin in his way, or some wardrobe, if found suitable. At all events, he wound up by concluding, eschewing for the nonce hidebound precedent, a cup of Epps cocoa and a shakedown for the night, plus the use of a rug or two and overcoat doubled into a pillow. At least he would be in safe hands, and as warm as toast on a trivet. He failed to perceive any very vast amount of harm in that, always with the proviso, no rumpus of any sort was kicked up. A move had to be made, because that merry old soul, the grass widower in question, who appeared to be glued to the spot, didn't appear in any particular hurry to wend his way home to his dearly beloved Queenstown, and it was highly likely some sponger's bawdy house of retired beauties off Sherwood Street Lower would be the best clue to that equivocal character's whereabouts for a few days to come, alternately racking their feelings, the mermaids, with six-chamber revolver anecdotes verging on the tropical, calculated to freeze the marrow of anybody's bones, and mauling their large-sized charms between whiles with rough-and-tumble gusto to the accompaniment of large potations of potsheen, and the usual blarney about himself, for as to who he in reality was, let XX equal my right name and address, as Mr. Algebra remarks passim. At the same time, he inwardly chuckled over his repartee to the Blood and Oons champion about his god being a Jew. People could put up with being bitten by a wolf, but what properly riled them was a bite from a sheep. The most vulnerable point, too, of tender Achilles, your god was a Jew, because mostly they appeared to imagine he came from Carrick and Shannon or somewhere about, in the County Sligo. I propose, our hero eventually suggested, after mature reflection, while prudently pocketing her photo, as it's rather stuffy here, you just come with me and talk things over. My diggings are quite close in the vicinity. You can't drink that stuff. Wait, I'll just pay this lot. The best plan clearly being to clear out, the remainder being plain sailing, he beckoned, while prudently pocketing the photo, to the keeper of the shanty, who didn't seem to... Yes, that's the best, he assured Stephen, to whom, for the matter of that brazen head, or him, or anywhere else, was all more or less. All kinds of utopian plans were flashing through his, Bloom's busy brain. Education, the genuine article, literature, journalism, prize titbits, up-to-date billing, hydros and concert tours in English watering resorts, packed with theatres, turning money away, duets in Italian with an accent perfectly true to nature, and a quantity of other things. No necessity, of course, to tell the world and his wife from the housetops about it, and a slice of luck. An opening was always wanted because he more than suspected he had his father's voice to bank his hopes on, which was quite on the cards he had, so it would be just as well, by the way no harm, to trail the conversation in the direction of that particular red herring, just to... The cabbie read out of the paper he had got hold of that the former viceroy, Earl Cadogan, had presided at the Cab Drivers Association dinner in London somewhere. The silence, with a yawn or two, accompanied this thrilling announcement. Then the old specimen in the corner, who appeared to have some spark of vitality left, read out that Sir Anthony MacDonald had left Euston for the Chief Secretary's Lodge, or words to that effect, to which absorbing piece of intelligence, Echo answered, "Why?" "Give us a squint at that literature, grandfather," the ancient mariner put in, manifesting some natural impatience. "And welcome," answered the elderly party thus addressed. The sailor lugged out from a case he had a pair of greenish goggles, which he very slowly hooked over his nose and both ears. "Are you bad in the eyes?" the sympathetic personage, like the town clerk, queried. "Why," answered the seafarer with the tartan beard, who seemingly was a bit of a literary cove in his own small way, staring out of sea-green portholes, as you might well describe them as, "I use goggles reading. Sand in the Red Sea, done that. One time I could read a book in the dark, manner of speaking. The Arabian Nights entertainment was my favourite, and red as a rose is she.
Thereupon he poured the journal open, and poured upon Lord only knows what, found drowned, or the exploits of King Willow, Ironmonger having made 100 and something, second wicket not out for knots, during which time, completely regardless of ire, the keeper was intensely occupied loosening an apparently new or second-hand boot which manifestly pinched him, as he muttered against whoever it was sold it. All of them who were sufficiently awake enough to be picked out by their facial expressions, that is to say, either simply looking on glumly or passing a trivial remark. To cut a long story short, Bloom, grasping the situation, was the first to rise to his feet, so as not to outstay their welcome, having first and foremost, being as good as his word that he would foot the bill for the occasion, taken the wise precaution to unobtrusively motion to mine host as a parting shot, a scarcely perceptible sign when the others were not looking, to the effect that the amount due was forthcoming, making a grand total of 4 pence, the amount he deposited unobtrusively in 4 coppers, literally the last of the Mohegans, he having previously spotted on the printed price list for all who ran to read, opposite to him, in unmistakable figures, coffee, 2 pence, confectionery, ditto, and honestly, well worth twice the money once in a way, as Weatherup used to remark. Come, he counselled, to close the seance. Seeing that the ruse worked and the coast was clear, they left the shelter or shanty together, and the elite society of Oilskin and Company, whom nothing short of an earthquake would move out of their dolce far niente. Stephen, who confessed to still feeling poorly and fagged out, paused at the, for a moment, the door to...
One thing I never understood, he said, to be original on the spur of the moment, why they put tables upside down at night, I mean chairs, upside down on the tables in cafes.
To which impromptu, the never-failing Bloom replied, without a moment's hesitation, saying straight off, to sweep the floor in the morning. So saying, he skipped around nimbly, considering frankly at the same time apologetic, to get on his companion's right, a habit of his, by the by, the right side being, in classical idiom, his tender Achilles. The night air was certainly now a treat to breathe. Though Stephen was a bit weak on his pins, it will, the air, do you good, Bloom said, meaning also the walk in a moment. The only thing is to walk, then you'll feel a different man. It's not far. Lean on me. Accordingly, he passed his left arm in Stephen's right, and led him on accordingly.
Yes, Stephen said uncertainly,
because he thought he felt a strange kind of flesh of a different man approach him, sinewless and wobbly and all that. Anyhow, they passed the sentry box with stones, braziers, etc., where the municipal supernumerary, ex-Gumley, was still to all intents and purposes wrapped in the arms of Murphy, as the adage has it, dreaming of fresh fields and pastures new. And apropos of coffin of stones, the analogy was not at all bad, as it was in fact a stoning to death on the part of 72 out of 80-odd constituencies that ratted at the time of the split, and chiefly the belauded peasant class, probably the selfsame evicted tenants he had put in their holdings. So they passed on to chatting about music, a form of art for which Bloom, as a pure amateur, possessed the greatest love, as they made tracks arm in arm across Beresford Place. Wagnerian music, though confessedly grand in its way, was a bit too heavy for Bloom, and hard to follow at the first go-off, but the music of Mercadante's Huguenots, Meyerbeer's 7 Last Words on the Cross, and Mozart's 12th Mass, he simply revelled in, the gloria in that being to his mind the acme of first-class music as such, literally knocking everything else into a cocked hat. He infinitely preferred the sacred music of the Catholic Church to anything the opposite shop could offer in that line, such as those moody and sankey hymns, or Bid Me to Live, and I Will Live Thy Protestant to Be. He also yielded to none in his admiration of Rossini's Stabat Mater, a work simply abounding in immortal numbers, in which his wife, Madame Marion Tweedy, made a hit, a veritable sensation, he might safely say, greatly adding to our other laurels, and putting the others totally in the shade in the Jesuit's father's church in Upper Garden Street, the sacred edifice being thronged to the doors to hear her with virtuosos, or virtuosi, rather. There was the unanimous opinion that there was none to come up to her, and suffice it to say, in a place of worship for music of a sacred character, there was a generally voiced desire for an encore. On the whole, though favouring preferably light opera of the Don Giovanni description, and Martha, a gem in its line, he had a penchant, though with only a surface knowledge, for the severe classical school, such as Mendelssohn. And talking of that,
Taking it for granted he knew all about the old favourites, he mentioned par excellence Lionel's air in Martha, Ma Paris, which, curiously enough, he heard, or overheard to be more accurate, on yesterday, a privilege he keenly appreciated from the lips of Stephen's respected father, sung to perfection, a study of the number, in fact, which made all the others take a back seat. Stephen, in reply to a politely put query, said he didn't, but launched out into praises of Shakespeare's songs, at least of in or about that period. The lutenist Dowland, who lived in Fetter Lane near Gerard the herbalist, who anno ludendo hausi Dolandus, an instrument he was contemplating purchasing from Mr. Arnold Dolmetsch, whom Bloom did not quite recall, though the name certainly sounded familiar, for 65 guineas, and Farnby and Son, with their Dux and Comes conceits, and Bird William, who played the virginals, he said, in the Queen's Chapel, or anywhere else he found them, and one Tompkins, who made toys or airs, and John Bull. On the roadway, which they were approaching while still speaking, beyond the swing chain, a horse dragging a sweeper paced on the paven ground, brushing a long swathe of mire up, so that with the noise Bloom was not perfectly certain whether he had caught aright the allusion to 65 guineas and John Bull. He inquired if it was John Bull, the political celebrity of that ilk, as it struck him the two identical names as a striking coincidence. By the chains, the horse slowly swerved to turn, which, perceiving Bloom, who was keeping a sharp lookout, as usual, plucked the other sleeve gently, jocosely remarking, "Our lives are in peril tonight. Beware of the steamroller." They thereupon stopped. Bloom looked at the head of a horse, not worth anything like 65 guineas, suddenly in evidence in the dark, quite near, so that it seemed new, a different grouping of bones and even flesh, because palpably it was a forewalker, a hip-shaker, a black-buttocker, a tail-dangler, a head-hanger, putting his hind foot foremost, the while the lord of his creation sat on the perch, busy with his thoughts. But such a good poor brute. He was sorry he hadn't a lump of sugar, but as he wisely reflected, you could scarcely be prepared for every emergency that might crop up. He was just a big, foolish, nervous, noodly kind of a horse, without a second care in the world. But even a dog, he reflected, take that mongrel in Barney Kiernan's of the same size, would be a holy horror to face. But it was no animal's fault in particular if he was built that way, like the camel, ship of the desert, distilling grapes into potsheen in his hump. 9/10 of them all could be caged or trained, nothing beyond the art of man, barring the bees. Whale with a harpoon hairpin, alligator, tickle the small of his back and he sees the joke, chalk a circle for a rooster, tiger, my eagle eye. These timely reflections anent the brutes of the field occupied his mind, somewhat distracted from Stephen's words, while the ship of the street was manoeuvring, and Stephen went on about the highly interesting old— "What's this I was saying? Ah, yes, my wife," he intimated, plunging in medias res, "would have the greatest of pleasure in making your acquaintance, as she is passionately attached to music of any kind." He looked sideways, in a friendly fashion, at the side face of Stephen, image of his mother, which was not quite the same as the usual blackguard type they unquestionably had an indubitable hankering after, as he was perhaps not that way built. Still, supposing he had his father's gift, as he more than suspected, it opened up new vistas in his mind, such as Lady Fingold's Irish Industries concert on the preceding Monday, and aristocracy in general. Exquisite variations he was now describing on an air, "Youth Here Has End," by Jans Peter Swelink, a Dutchman of Amsterdam, where the Frau's come from. Even more he liked an old German song of Johannes Yeep, about the clear sea and the voices of sirens, sweet murderers of men, which boggled Bloom a bit.
Von der serenen Listigkeit tun de Poeten dichten.
These opening bars he sang and translated extempore. Bloom, nodding, said he perfectly understood and begged him to go on by all means, which he did. A phenomenally beautiful tenor voice like that, the rarest of boons, which Bloom appreciated at the very first note he got out, could easily, if properly handled by some recognized authority on voice production, such as Barraclough, and being able to read music into the bargain, command its own price, where baritones were 10 a penny, and procure for its fortunate possessor in the near future an entree into fashionable houses in the best residential quarters, or financial magnate in a large way of business, and titled people where, with his university degree of B.A., a huge ad in its way, and gentlemanly bearing to all the more influence the good impression, he would infallibly score a distinct success, being blessed with brains, which also could be utilized for the purpose, and other requisites, if his clothes were properly attended to, so as to the better worm his way into their good graces, as he, a youthful tyro, in society's sartorial niceties, hardly understood how a little thing like that could militate against you. It was, in fact, only a matter of months, and he could easily foresee him participating in their musical and artistic conversaciones during the festivities of the Christmas season for choice, causing a slight flutter in the dovecotes of the fair sex, and being made a lot of by ladies out for sensation, cases of which, as he happened to know, were on record. In fact, without giving the show away, he himself, once upon a time, if he cared to, could easily have. Added to which, of course, would be the pecuniary emolument, by no means to be sneezed at, going hand in hand with his tuition fees. Not, he parenthesized, that for the sake of filthy lucre he need necessarily embrace the lyric platform as a walk in life for any lengthy space of time, but a step in the required direction it was, beyond yea or nay, and both monetarily and mentally it contained no reflection on his dignity in the smallest, and it often turned in uncommonly handy to be handed a check at a much-needed moment when every little helped. Besides, though, taste latterly had deteriorated to a degree. Original music like that, different from the conventional rut, would rapidly have a great vogue, as it would be a decided novelty for Dublin's musical world, after the usual hackneyed run of catchy tenor solos foisted on a confiding public by Ivan St. Austell and Hilton St. Just and their genus omne. Yes, beyond the shadow of a doubt, he could, with all the cards in his hand, and he had a capital opening to make a name for himself and win a high place in the city's esteem, where he could command a stiff figure and, booking ahead, give a grand concert for the patrons of the King Street House, given a backer-up, if one were forthcoming, to kick him upstairs, so to speak, a big if, however, with some impetus of the go-ahead sort to obviate the inevitable procrastination which often tripped up a too-much-fated prince of good fellows. And it need not detract from the others by one iota, as, being his own master, he would have heaps of time to practice literature in his spare moments, when desirous of so doing, without its clashing with his vocal career, or containing anything derogatory whatsoever, as it was a matter for himself alone. In fact, he had the ball at his feet, and that was the very reason why the other, possessed of a remarkably sharp nose for smelling a rat of any sort, hung on to him at all. The horse was just then, and later on, at a propitious opportunity, he purposed, Bloom did, without any way prying into his private affairs on the fool step in where angels principle, advising him to sever his connection with a certain budding practitioner, who he noticed was prone to disparage, and even to a slight extent, with some hilarious pretext, when not present, deprecate him, or whatever you like to call it, which in Bloom's humble opinion threw a nasty sidelight on that side of a person's character, no pun intended. The horse, having reached the end of his tether, so to speak, halted, and rearing high a proud feathering tail, added his quota by letting fall on the floor, which the brush would soon brush up and polish, three smoking globes of turds. Slowly, three times, one after another, from a full crupper, he mired. And humanely his driver waited till he or she had ended, patient in his scythed car. Side by side, Bloom, profiting by the contretemps, with Stephen, passed through the gap of the chains, divided by the upright, and stepping over a strand of mire, went across towards Gardiner Street Lower, Stephen singing more boldly, but not loudly, the end of the ballad.
Und alle Schiffe brücken.
The driver never said a word, good, bad, or indifferent. He merely watched the two figures as he sat in his low-back car, both black, one full, one lean, walked towards the railway bridge, to be married by Father Marr. As they walked, they at times stopped and walked again, continuing their tete-a-tete, which of course he was utterly out of, about sirens, enemies of man's reason, mingled with a number of other topics of the same category, usurpers, historical cases of the kind, while the man in the sweeper car, or you might as well call it in the sleeper car, who in any case couldn't possibly hear because they were too far, simply sat in his seat near the end of Lower Gardiner Street,
and looked after their low-back car.
Vada mia, il catalogo è questo, delle belle che vuoi, vada mio, un catalogo gli è passatio, osservate, leggete con me, osservate. osservate, leggete con me. In Italia 640, in Germania 231, 100 in Francia, in Turchia 91, ma in Spagna.
What parallel courses did Bloom and Stephen follow returning? Starting united both at normal walking pace from Beresford's Place, they followed in the order named Lower and Middle Gardiner Streets and Mountjoy Square West, then at reduced pace, each bearing left, Gardiner's Place, by an inadvertence as far as the far corner of Temple Street North, then at reduced pace with interruptions of halt, bearing right, Temple Street North as far as Hardwick Place. Approaching disparate at relaxed walking pace, they crossed both the circus before George's Church diametrically, the chord in any circle being less than the arc which it subtends. Of what did the duumvirate deliberate during their itinerary? Music, literature, Ireland, Dublin, Paris, friendship, woman, prostitution, diet? The influence of gaslight or the light of arc and glow lamps on the growth of adjoining paraheliotropic trees? Exposed corporation emergency dust buckets, the Roman Catholic Church, ecclesiastical celibacy, the Irish nation, Jesuit education, careers, the study of medicine, the past day, the maleficent influence of the pre-Sabbath, Stephen's collapse. Did Bloom discover common factors of similarity between their respective like and unlike reactions to experience? Both were sensitive to artistic impressions musical, in preference to plastic or pictorial. Both preferred a continental to an insular manner of life, a cisatlantic to a transatlantic place of residence. Both indurated by early domestic training and an inherited tenacity of heterodox resistance, professed their disbelief in many orthodox religious, national, social, and ethical doctrines. Both admitted the alternately stimulating and obtunding influence of heterosexual magnetism. Were their views on some points divergent? Stephen dissented openly from Bloom's views on the importance of dietary and civic self-help, while Bloom dissented tacitly from Stephen's views on the eternal affirmation of the spirit of man in literature. Bloom assented covertly to Stephen's rectification of the anachronism involved in assigning the date of the conversion of the Irish nation to Christianity from Druidism by Patrick, son of Calpurnus, son of Potitus, son of Odysseus, sent by Pope Celestine I in the year 432 in the reign of Leary, to the year 260 or thereabouts in the reign of Cormac MacArt, 266 AD, suffocated by imperfect deglutition of aliment at Sletty and interred at Rosnaree. The collapse, which Bloom ascribed to gastric inanition and certain chemical compounds of varying degrees of adulteration and alcoholic strength, accelerated by mental exertion and the velocity of rapid circular motion in a relaxing atmosphere, Stephen attributed to the reapparition of a matutinal cloud perceived by both from two different points of observation, Sandy Cove and Dublin, at first no bigger than a woman's hand. Was there one point on which their views were equal and negative? The influence of gaslight or electric light on the growth of adjoining paraheliotropic trees. Had Bloom discussed similar subjects during nocturnal perambulations in the past? In 1884, with Owen Goldberg and Cecil Turnbull, at night on public thoroughfares, between Longwood Avenue and Leonard's Corner, and Leonard's Corner and Sing Street, and Sing Street and Bloomfield Avenue. In 1885, with Percy Apjohn, in the evenings, reclined against the wall between Gibraltar Villa and Bloomfield House in Crumlin, Barony of Uppercross. In 1886, occasionally, with casual acquaintances and prospective purchasers on doorsteps, in front parlours, in third-class railway carriages of suburban lines. In 1888, frequently, with Major Brian Tweedy and his daughter, Miss Marion Tweedy, together and separately, on the lounge in Matthew Dillon's house in Roundtown. Once, in 1892, and once in 1893, with Julius Mastiansky, on both occasions in the parlour of his, Bloom's house, in Lombard Street West. What reflection, concerning the irregular sequence of dates, 1884, 1885, 1886, 1888, 1892, 1893, 1904, did Bloom make before their arrival at their destination? He reflected that the progressive extension of the field of individual development and experience was regressively accompanied by a restriction of the converse domain of inter-individual relations. As in what ways? From inexistence to existence, he came to many and was as one received. Existence with existence, he was with any, as any with any. From existence to non-existence gone, he would be by all as none perceived. What action did Bloom make on their arrival at their destination? At the house steps of the fourth of the equidifferent uneven numbers, number 7 Eckler Street, he inserted his hand mechanically into the back pocket of his trousers to obtain his latch key. Was it there? It was in the corresponding pocket of the trousers, which he had worn on the day but one preceding. Why was he doubly irritated? Because he had forgotten, and because he remembered that he reminded himself twice not to forget. What were then the alternatives before the premeditatedly, respectively, and inadvertently keyless couple? To enter or not to enter? To knock or not to knock? Bloom's decision? A stratagem. Resting his feet on the dwarf wall, he climbed over the area railings, compressed his hat on his head, grasped two points at the lower union of rails and stiles, lowered his body gradually by its length of 5'9" and a half to within 2'10" of the area pavement, and allowed his body to move freely in space by separating himself from the railings and crouching in preparation for the impact of the fall. Did he fall? By his body's known weight, of 11 stone and 4 pounds in avoirdupois measure, as certified by the graduated machine for periodical self-weighing in the premises of Francis Frodman, pharmaceutical chemist of 19 Frederick Street North, on the last feast of the Ascension, to wit, the 12th day of May, of the bisextile year 1904 of the Christian era, Jewish era 5664, Mohammedan era 1322, Golden Number 5, Epact 13, Solar Cycle 9, Dominical Letter CB, Roman Indication 2, Julian Period 6617, MXM 1V. Did he rise uninjured by concussion? Regaining new stable equilibrium, he rose uninjured, though concussed by the impact, raised the latch of the area door by the exertion of force at its freely moving flange, and by leverage of the first kind, applied at his fulcrum, gained retarded access to the kitchen through the sub-adjacent scullery, ignited a lucifer match by friction, set free inflammable coal gas by turning on the vent cock, lit a high flame, which by regulating he reduced to quiescent candescence, and lit finally a portable candle. What discreet succession of images did Stephen meanwhile perceive? Reclined against the area railings, he perceived through the transparent kitchen panes a man regulating a gas flame of 14 CP, a man lighting a candle, a man removing in turn each of his two boots, a man leaving the kitchen holding a candle of 1 CP. Did the man reappear elsewhere? After a lapse of 4 minutes, the glimmer of his candle was discernible through the semi-transparent semicircular glass fanlight over the hall door. The hall door turned gradually on its hinges. In the open space of the doorway, the man reappeared, without his hat, with his candle. Did Stephen obey his sign? Yes. Entering softly, he helped to close and chain the door, and followed softly along the hallway the man's back and listed feet, and lighted candle, past a lighted crevice of doorway on the left, and carefully down a turning staircase of more than 5 steps into the kitchen of Bloom's house. What did Bloom do? He extinguished the candle by a sharp expiration of breath upon its flame, drew 2 spoon-seat deal chairs to the hearthstone, one for Stephen with his back to the area window, the other for himself when necessary, knelt on one knee, composed in the greater pyre of cross-laid resin-tipped sticks and various coloured papers, and irregular polygons of best Abram coal at 21 shillings a ton from the yard of Messrs. Flower and MacDonald of 14 De Lear Street, kindled it at 3 projecting points of paper with 1 ignited lucifer match, thereby releasing the potential energy contained in the fuel by allowing its carbon and hydrogen elements to enter into free union with the oxygen of the air. Of what similar apparitions did Stephen think? Of others elsewhere, in other times, who, kneeling on one knee or on 2, had kindled fires for him. of Brother Michael in the infirmary of the College of the Society of Jesus at Clongowes Wood, Sallins, in the county of Kildare, of his father, Simon Dedalus, in an unfurnished room of his first residence in Dublin, No. 13 Fitzgibbon Street, of his godmother, Miss Kate Morkan, in the house of her dying sister, Miss Julia Morkan, at 15 Usher's Island, of his mother Mary, wife of Simon Dedalus, in the kitchen of No. 12 North Richmond Street, on the morning of the Feast of St. Francis Xavier, 1898, of the Dean of Studies, Father Butt, in the Physics Theatre of University College, 16 Stephen's Green North, of his sister Dilly, Delia, in his father's house in Cabra. What did Stephen see, on raising his gaze to the height of a yard, from the fire towards the opposite wall? Under a row of five coiled spring house bells, a curvilinear rope, stretched between two holdfasts, athwart across the recess beside the chimney pier, from which hung four small-sized square handkerchiefs, folded unattached consecutively in adjacent rectangles, and one pair of ladies' grey hose with lisle suspender tops and feet in their habitual position, clamped by three erect wooden pegs, two at the outer extremities, and the third at their point of junction. What did Bloom see on the range? On the right, smaller hob, a blue enamel saucepan. On the left, larger hob, a black iron kettle. What did Bloom do at the range? He removed the saucepan to the left hob, rose, and carried the iron kettle to the sink in order to tap the current by turning the faucet to let it flow. Did it flow? Yes. From Roundwood Reservoir in County Wicklow, of a cubic capacity of 2,400 million gallons, percolating through a subterranean aqueduct of filter mains of single and double pipage, constructed at an initial plant cost of £5 per linear yard, by way of the Dargle, Rathdown, Glen of the Downs, and Callow Hill, to the 26-acre reservoir at Stillorgan, a distance of 22 statute miles, and thence, through a system of relieving tanks by a gradient of 250 feet, to the city boundary at Eustace Bridge, Upper Leeston Street. Though from prolonged summer drought and daily supply of 12.5 million gallons, the water had fallen below the sill of the overflow weir, for which reason the borough surveyor and waterworks engineer, Mr. Spencer Harty, C.E., on the instructions of the waterworks committee, had prohibited the use of municipal water for purposes other than those of consumption, envisaging the possibility of recourse being had to the impotable water of the Grand and Royal Canals, as in 1893, particularly as the South Dublin Guardians, notwithstanding their ration of 15 gallons per day per pauper, supplied through a 6-inch meter, had been convicted of a wastage of 20,000 gallons per night by a reading of the meter on the affirmation of the law agent of the corporation, Mr. Ignatius Rice, solicitor, thereby acting to the detriment of another section of the public, self-supporting taxpayers, solvent, sound. What in water did Bloom, water lover, drawer of water, water carrier, returning to the range, admire? Its universality, its democratic quality and constancy to its nature in seeking its own level, its vastness in the ocean of Mercator's projection, its unplumbed profundity in the Sumdam Trench of the Pacific, exceeding 8,000 fathoms, the restlessness of its waves and surface particles, visiting in turn all points of its seaboard, the independence of its units, the variability of states of sea, its hydrostatic quiescence in calm, its hydrokinetic turgidity in neap and spring tides, its subsidence after devastation, its sterility in the circumpolar ice caps, Arctic and Antarctic, its climatic and commercial significance, its preponderance of 3-1 over the dry land of the globe, its indisputable hegemony extending in square leagues over all the regions below the sub-equatorial Tropic of Capricorn, the multisecular stability of its primeval basin, its luteofulvous bed, its capacity to dissolve and hold in solution all soluble substances, including millions of tons of the most precious metals, its slow erosions of peninsulas and downward-tending promontories, its alluvial deposits, its weight and volume and density, its imperturbability in lagoons and highland tarns, its gradation of colours in the torrid and temperate and frigid zones, its vehicular ramifications in continental lake-contained streams and confluent ocean-flowing rivers with their tributaries and transoceanic currents, Gulf Stream, North and South Equatorial courses, its violence in sea quakes, water spouts, artesian wells, eruptions, torrents, eddies, freshets, spates, groundswells, watersheds, water partings, geysers, cataracts, whirlpools, maelstroms, inundations, deluges, cloudbursts, its vast circumterrestrial ahorizontal curve, its secrecy in springs and latent humidity, revealed by rhabdomantic or hygrometric instruments and exemplified by the hole in the wall at Ashdown Gate. Saturation of air, distillation of dew, the simplicity of its composition, two constituent parts of hydrogen with one constituent part of oxygen, its healing virtues, its buoyancy in the waters of the Dead Sea, its persevering penetrativeness in runnels, gullies, inadequate dams, leaks on shipboard, its properties for cleansing, quenching thirst and fire, nourishing vegetation, its infallibility as paradigm and paragon, its metamorphoses as vapor, mist, cloud, rain, sleet, snow, hail, its strength in rigid hydrants, its variety of forms in locks and bays and gulfs and bights and guts and lagoons and atolls and archipelagos and sands and fjords and minches and tidal estuaries and arms of sea, its solidity in glaciers, icebergs, ice flows, its docility in working hydraulic mill wheels, turbines, dynamos, electric power stations, bleach works, tanneries, scotch mills, its utility in canals, rivers, if navigable, floating and graving docks, its potentiality derivable from harnessed tides or watercourses falling from level to level, its submarine fauna and flora, an acoustic, photophobe, numerically, if not literally, the inhabitants of the globe, its ubiquity as constituting 90% of the human body, the noxiousness of its effluvia in lacustrine marshes, pestilential fens, faded flower water, stagnant pools in the waning moon. Having set the half-filled kettle on the now-burning coals, why did he return to the still-flowing tap? To wash his soiled hands with a partially consumed tablet of Barrington's lemon-flavoured soap, to which paper still adhered, bought 13 hours previously for 4 pence and still unpaid for, in fresh, cold, never-changing, ever-changing water, and dry them, face and hands, in a long, red-bordered holland cloth passed over a wooden revolving roller. What reason did Stephen give for declining Bloom's offer? That he was hydrophobe, hating partial contact by immersion or total by submersion in cold water, his last bath having taken place in the month of October of the preceding year, disliking the aqueous substances of glass and crystal, distrusting aquacities of thought and language. What impeded Bloom from giving Stephen counsels of hygiene and prophylactic, to which should be added suggestions concerning a preliminary wetting of the head and contraction of the muscles, with rapid splashing of the face and neck and thoracic and epigastric region in case of sea or river bathing, the parts of the human anatomy most sensitive to cold being the nape, stomach and fena, or sole of foot? The incompatibility of aquacity with the erratic originality of genius. What additional didactic counsels did he similarly repress? Dietary, concerning the respective percentage of protein and caloric energy in bacon, salt, ling, and butter, the absence of the former in the last named and the abundance of the latter in the first named. Which seemed to the host to be the predominant qualities of his guest? Confidence in himself, an equal and opposite power of abandonment and recuperation. What concomitant phenomenon took place in the vessel of liquid by the agency of fire? The phenomenon of ebullition. Fanned by a constant updraft of ventilation between the kitchen and the chimney flue, ignition was communicated from the faggots of precombustible fuel to polyhedral masses of bituminous coal, containing in compressed mineral form the foliated fossilized decidua of primeval forests, which had in turn derived their vegetative existence from the sun, primal source of heat, radiant, transmitted through omnipresent, luminiferous, diathermanous ether. Heat convected, a mode of motion developed by such combustion, was constantly and increasingly conveyed from the source of calorification to the liquid contained in the vessel, being radiated through the uneven, unpolished, dark surface of the metal iron, in part reflected, in part absorbed, in part transmitted, gradually raising the temperature of the water from normal to boiling point. A rise in temperature expressible as the result of an expenditure of 72 thermal units needed to raise 1 pound of water from 50 degrees to 212 degrees Fahrenheit. What announced the accomplishment of this rise in temperature? A double falciform ejection of water vapor from under the kettle lid at both sides simultaneously. For what personal purpose could Bloom have applied the water so boiled? To shave himself. What advantages attended shaving by night? A softer beard, a softer brush, if intentionally allowed to remain from shave to shave in its agglutinated lather, a softer skin, if unexpectedly encountering female acquaintances in remote places at uncustomary hours, quiet reflection upon the course of the day, a cleaner sensation when awaking after a fresher sleep, since matutinal noises, premonitions and perturbations, a tattered milk can, a postman's double knock, a paper read, re-read while lathering, re-lathering the same spot, a shock, a shoot, with thought of aught he sought, though fraught with naught, might cause a faster rate of shaving, and a nick on which incision, plaster with precision cut, and humected, and applied adhered, which was to be done. Why did absence of light disturb him less than presence of noise? Because of the surety of the sense of touch in his firm, full, masculine, feminine, passive, active hand. What quality did it, his hand, possess, but with what counteracting influence? The operative surgical quality, but that he was reluctant to shed human blood, even when the end justified the means, preferring in their natural order heliotherapy, psychophysicotherapeutics, osteopathic surgery. What lay under exposure on the lower, middle, and upper shelves of the kitchen dresser opened by Bloom? On the lower shelf, 5 vertical breakfast plates, 6 horizontal breakfast saucers, on which rested inverted breakfast cups, a moustache cup, uninverted, and saucer of Crown Derby, 4 white gold-rimmed egg cups, and open chamois purse, displaying coins, mostly copper, and a file of aromatic violet comfits. On the middle shelf, a chipped egg cup containing pepper, a drum of table salt, 4 conglomerated black olives in oleaginous paper, an empty pot of plum trees potted meat, an oval wicker basket bedded with fibre and containing 1 Jersey pear, a half-empty bottle of William Gilby & Co.'s white invalid port, half disrobed of its swathe of coral pink tissue paper, a packet of Epps soluble cocoa, 5 ounces of Ann Lynch's choice tea at 2 shillings per pound in a crinkle lead paper bag, a cylindrical canister containing the best crystallized lump sugar, 2 onions, 1, the larger, Spanish, entire, the other, smaller, Irish, bisected with augmented surface and more redolent, a jar of Irish Model Dairy's cream, a jug of brown crockery containing a noggin and a quarter of soured adulterated milk converted by heat into water, acidulous serum and semi-solidified curds, which, added to the quantity subtracted from Mr. Bloom's and Mrs. Fleming's breakfasts, made 1 imperial pint, the total quantity originally delivered. 2 cloves, a halfpenny, and a small dish containing a slice of fresh rib steak. On the upper shelf, a battery of jam jars of various sizes and provenances. What attracted his attention lying on the apron of the dresser? 4 polygonal fragments of 2 lacerated scarlet betting tickets, numbered 8, 8, 7, 8, 8, 6. What reminiscences temporarily corrugated his brow? Reminiscences of coincidences, truth stranger than fiction, pre-indicative of the result of the Gold Cup flat handicap, the official and definitive result of which he had read in the Evening Telegraph, late pink edition in the cabman's shelter at Butt Bridge. Where had previous intimations of the result, effected or projected, been received by him? In Bernard Kiernan's licensed premises, 8, 9, and 10 Little Britain Street, in David Byrne's licensed premises, 14 Duke Street, in O'Connell Street Lower, outside Graham Lemon's, when a dark man had placed in his hand a throwaway, subsequently thrown away, advertising Elijah, restorer of the church in Zion, in Lincoln Place, outside the premises of F.W. Sweeney & Co., Ltd., dispensing chemists, when Frederick M. Bantam Lyons had rapidly and successfully requested, perused, and restituted the copy of the current issue of the Freeman's Journal and National Press, which he had been about to throw away, subsequently thrown away. He had proceeded towards the oriental edifice of the Turkish and Warm Baths, 11 Leinster Street, with a light of inspiration shining in his countenance, and bearing in his arms the secret of the race, graven in the language of prediction. What qualifying considerations allayed his perturbations? The difficulties of interpretation, since the significance of any event followed its occurrence as variably as the acoustic report followed the electrical discharge, and of counterestimating against an actual loss by failure to interpret the total sum of possible losses proceeding originally from a successful interpretation. His mood? He had not risked, he did not expect, he had not been disappointed. He was satisfied. What satisfied him? To have sustained no positive loss, to have brought a positive gain to others, light to the Gentiles. How did Bloom prepare a collation for a Gentile? He poured into 2 teacups, 2 level spoonfuls, 4 in all, of Epps soluble cocoa, and proceeded according to the directions for use printed on the label, to each adding after sufficient time for infusion the prescribed ingredients for diffusion in the manner and in the quantity prescribed. What supererogatory marks of special hospitality did the host show his guest? Relinquishing his symposiarchal right to the moustache cup of imitation Crown Derby, presented to him by his only daughter Millicent Millie, he substituted a cup identical with that of his guest, and served extraordinarily to his guest, and in reduced measure to himself, the viscous cream ordinarily reserved for the breakfast of his wife Marion, Molly. Was the guest conscious of, and did he acknowledge, these marks of hospitality? His attention was directed to them by his host jocosely, and he accepted them seriously, as they drank in joco-serious silence Epps' mass product, the creature cocoa. Were there marks of hospitality, which he contemplated, but suppressed, reserving them for another and for himself on future occasions, to complete the act begun? The reparation of a fissure, of the length of 1.5 inches, in the right side of his guest's jacket. A gift to his guest of one of the 4 ladies' handkerchiefs, if and when ascertained to be in a presentable condition. Who drank more quickly? Bloom, having the advantage of 10 seconds at the initiation, and taking, from the concave surface of a spoon, along the handle of which a steady flow of heat was conducted, 3 sips to his opponent's 1, 6-2, 9-3. What cerebration accompanied his frequentative act? Concluding by inspection, but erroneously, that his silent companion was engaged in mental composition, he reflected on the pleasures derived from literature of instruction, rather than of amusement, as he himself had applied to the works of William Shakespeare more than once for the solution of difficult problems in imaginary or real life. Had he found their solution? In spite of careful and repeated reading of certain classical passages, aided by a glossary, he had derived imperfect conviction from the text, the answers not bearing on all points. What lines concluded his first piece of original verse written by him, potential poet, at the age of 11, in 1877, on the occasion of the offering of 3 prizes, of 10 shillings, 5 shillings, and 2 and 6 respectively, by the Shamrock, a weekly newspaper? An ambition to squint at my verses in print makes me hope that for these you'll find room. If you so condescend, then please place at the end the name of yours truly, L. Bloom. Did he find 4 separating forces between his temporary guest and him? Name, age, race, creed. What anagrams had he made on his name in youth? Leopold Bloom, El Pod Bermul, Molde Peloub, Bolla Pedum, Old Olibo MP. What acrostic, upon the abbreviation of his first name, had he, kinetic poet, sent to Miss Marion Tweedy on the 14th of February, 1888? Poets oft have sung in rhyme, of music sweet their praise divine. Let them hymn it 9 times 9, dearer far than song or wine. You are mine, the world is mine. What had prevented him from completing a topical song, music by R. G. Johnson, on the events of the past, or fixtures for the actual years, entitled If Brian Boru Could But Come Back and See Old Dublin Now? Commissioned by Michael Gunn, lessee of the Gaiety Theatre, 46, 47, 48, 49 South King Street, and to be introduced into the 6th scene, The Valley of Diamonds, of the 2nd edition, 30th of January, 1893, of the grand annual Christmas pantomime, Sinbad the Sailor, written by Greenleaf Whittier, scenery by George A. Jackson and Cecil Hicks, costumes by Mrs. and Miss Whelan, produced by R. Shelton, 26th of December, 1892, under the personal supervision of Mrs. Michael Gunn, ballets by Jesse Noir, harlequinade by Thomas Otto, and sung by Nellie Bouverist, principal girl. Firstly, oscillation between events of imperial and of local interest. The anticipated Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria, born 1820, acceded 1837, and the posticipated opening of the new municipal fish market. Secondly, apprehension of opposition from extreme circles on the questions of the respective visits of the Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of York, real, and His Majesty King Brian Boru, imaginary. Thirdly, a conflict between professional etiquette and professional emulation concerning the recent erections of the Grand Lyric Hall on Burgh Quay and the Theatre Royal in Hawkins Street. Fourthly, distraction resultant from compassion for Nellie Bouverett's non-intellectual, non-political, non-topical expression of countenance and concupiscence caused by Nellie Bouverett's revelations of white articles of non-intellectual, non-political, non-topical underclothing, while she, Nellie Bouverett, was in the articles. Fifthly, the difficulties of the selection of appropriate music and humorous allusions from Everybody's Book of Jokes, 1,000 pages and a laugh in every one. Sixthly, the rhymes homophonous and cacophonous associated with the names of the new Lord Mayor Daniel Tallon, the new High Sheriff Thomas Pyle, and the new Solicitor General Dunbar Plunkett Barton. What relation existed between their ages? 16 years before, in 1888, when Bloom was of Stephen's present age, Stephen was 6. 16 years after, in 1920, when Stephen would be of Bloom's present age, Bloom would be 54. In 1936, when Bloom would be 70 and Stephen 54, their ages initially, in the ratio of 16 to naught, would be as 17.5 to 13.5, the proportion increasing and the disparity diminishing according as arbitrary future years were added. For if the proportion existing in 1883 had continued immutable, conceiving that to be possible till then 1904 when Stephen was 22, Bloom would be 374, and in 1920 when Stephen would be 38 as Bloom then was, Bloom would be 646, while in 1952 when Stephen would have attained the maximum post-alluvian age of 70, Bloom, being 1,190 years alive, having been born in the year 714, would have surpassed by 221 years the maximum antediluvian age, that of Methuselah, 969 years, while if Stephen would continue to live until he would attain that age in the year 3072 AD, Bloom would have been obliged to have been alive 83,300 years, having been obliged to have been born in the year 81,396 BC. What events might nullify these calculations? The cessation of existence of both or either, the inauguration of a new era or calendar, the annihilation of the world and consequent extermination of the human species, inevitable but unpredictable. How many previous encounters prove their pre-existing acquaintance? 2. The first in the lilac garden of Matthew Dillon's house, Medina Villa, Kimmage Road, Roundtown, in 1887, in the company of Stephen's mother, Stephen being then of the age of 5, and reluctant to give his hand in salutation. The second, in the coffee room of Breslin's Hotel, on a rainy Sunday, in the January of 1892, in the company of Stephen's father and Stephen's granduncle, Stephen being then 5 years older. Did Bloom accept the invitation to dinner given then by the son and afterwards seconded by the father? Very gratefully, with grateful appreciation, with sincere appreciative gratitude, in appreciatively grateful sincerity of regret, he declined. Did their conversation on the subject of these reminiscences reveal a third connecting link between them? Mrs. Reardon, a widow of independent means, had resided in the house of Stephen's parents from the 1st of September 1888 to the 29th of December 1891, and had also resided during the years 1892, 1893, and 1894 in the City Arms Hotel owned by Elizabeth O'Dowd of 54 Prussia Street, where during parts of the years 1892,